shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free.
The Herald of Truth broadcast is on the air, a program of spirit and truth dedicated to teaching the way of God more perfectly. These broadcasts contain keys to help unlock knowledge and reveal hidden truths of the Bible in these last days. Christians, called to a higher level of understanding, will be given Bible-based solutions to their personal as well as national problems. They will want to find out more about their part in God's plan. Our mailing address is Kingdom Identity Ministries, Post Office Box 1021, Harrison, Arkansas, 72602, and will be given again at the end of this broadcast.
Good evening. This is Brother Mike of Kingdom Identity Ministries, welcoming you to another one of our first of the month live Kingdom Concepts broadcasts. We're being heard tonight over shortwave radio station WWCR on 4.840 megahertz and 3.215 megahertz. That's transmitters 3 and transmitter 1. And also shortwave station WBCQ 7.490 megahertz. That's out of Maine. And WWCR is out of Nashville. You can go to our radio page by going to our website, kingidentity.com. And go to the radio page, and you can see some links for those stations if you want to listen over the internet. And there's also a live link from our page. If you'd like to participate in tonight's broadcast, you can call 877-924-7722. You can remember that by 877-YAWS-RACE. 877-924-7722. That's a toll-free number. Tonight's topic will be one that many of you have requested, the so-called Holocaust, or Holohoax as I call it. Despite God's blessings in our heritage and our nation, we need to be honest and admit that our history contains a lot of lies, manipulation, and betrayal of our Christian values. This includes unrighteous wars, war propaganda, war prophets. As Henry Ford said, wars are the Jews' harvests. To help develop these subjects, my guest is a man highly esteemed among his peers, the executive editor of the Barnes Review, chairman of the Free Expression Foundation, production director and assistant marketing manager for American Free Press, and a knowledgeable longtime patriot. We had him scheduled for the broadcast in July, but due to medical issues, he was unable to make it, and I'm glad that he's here tonight. I'd like to welcome to the broadcast Paul T. Angel.
Hey, Mike. Thanks for having me on. That's quite a subject, the Holocaust, to talk about. I'm glad that your listeners are interested in such things and are open-minded enough to realize that there's two sides to every story. And if they don't realize that now, looking at the way the news is being portrayed, for today's news, which is going to be history tomorrow, well, I don't think it's ever going to be more clear that our news and our history are being terribly manipulated on multiple levels. One of those topics is the Holocaust. I'm the executive editor of the Barnes Review, as you mentioned, as a revisionist history magazine, which discusses all kinds of topics. We are not beholden or focused totally on the Holocaust, but it is a subject that we do discuss, and we've published, I don't know, maybe 25 books in conjunction with revisionist scholars around the world. Mostly these books are prepared by Guillermo Rudolph of Castle Hill Publishing, but we have on our contributing editors board 6, 7, 8, what you would call Holocaust revisionists. And one of their badges of honor, of course, is to say that they've served time in prison in foreign countries, specifically in Europe, one in Australia, for discussing this very topic, which you cannot talk about in, like I said, I think between 13 to 17 European nations without getting yourself in serious trouble, monetary fines possible, getting locked up in prison, your career ruined, doxing, whatever it may be. So it's a dangerous topic, and it's one that is extremely taboo and politically charged today, as everybody knows. I always say at Christmas and Easter, when I'm looking for a program on Jesus, I'm more likely to find a program on the Holocaust. But anyway, I guess for our purposes, two things we have to define before we can really have a discussion, and one of those is the Holocaust. What is the Holocaust? What mainstream historiography says the Holocaust is, and our view on it. That would make us, if we don't take every single the fact that they allege is makes up the Holocaust, and of course we're called Holocaust deniers. So those are your two terms, are the Holocaust and the Holocaust deniers. Of course, people will come to me and they'll say, what do you don't believe in the Holocaust? And the first thing I'll say is, well, which Holocaust? I mean, there was the American Indian Holocaust, the slave Holocaust, the Armenian Holocaust, the Syrian Holocaust, you know, Greek Orthodox Holocaust conducted by the Turks. Was it the Cambodian Holocaust, the Chinese Holocaust, the Russian Christian Holocaust, where 60 million were killed by the Bolsheviks? Was it the Holocaust of World War I or World War II? So to me...
Well, certainly the Holocaust during World War II of the Allied bombing of Dresden.
Absolutely, and multiple other cities. So then they kind of look at me funny, and they're like, wait a minute, there were really all these other Holocausts? Well, it's not the Big H Holocaust. But in these other Holocausts, as I mentioned, you had... I'm going to take World War II, for instance. You had millions of dead people laying all over Europe, if not, and Asia, and that was certainly a Holocaust, Cambodian Holocaust, in which 50% of the population of Cambodia was killed. But we know what we're talking about. We're talking about the Jewish Holocaust. The Jewish Holocaust, then, would be defined by court historians, as Harry Elmer Barnes used to call them, the great revisionist scholar. You would have to define that as what they say it is. So we would think that would be that Adolf Hitler had an evil plan to exterminate European Jewry. And the way he did that was he killed exactly 6 million by locking them up in death camps, and the preferred weapon of choice were homicidal gas chambers. So if you don't believe any of those things, A, that Hitler had a plan at the Wannsee Conference, in which they determined that the final solution was an extermination plan, and if you don't say they were killed in homicidal gas chambers, then you're a Holocaust denier. But it might surprise people to know, you know, Debbie Lipstadt is a Jewish scholar. I believe she wrote the book Denying the Holocaust. She says there's more to denying the Holocaust than just denying those few simple facts or alleged facts. She says that if you believe that the seeds of World War II were planted in the treatment that Germany got following World War I, the awful Versailles Treaty. If you believe that that caused World War II, then you're a Holocaust denier. If you believe that Adolf Hitler didn't want to go to war against Poland or England, and we know he didn't because he had multiple peace offers and was actually quite restrained in his actions in Poland, which we can get into, then you're a Holocaust denier. If you believe that Franklin Roosevelt and Winston Churchill were maneuvering the United States and England to war, then you're a Holocaust denier. And of course, if you would even say, and don't tell me how her logic works, but if you say that FDR deliberately set the stage for the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor, then you're a Holocaust denier. Well, I would then make just about everybody that's been doing any real reading in history a Holocaust denier. Of course, being called a Holocaust denier is about the worst thing you can be called today. I always tell people if I was a lobbyist and I went to Capitol Hill and I went to a congressman's office and I told them that I was from, say, NAMBLA, the National Association of Man Boy Love, right? Oh, they'd probably give me an appointment to come in and talk to them. But if I was to say, or they called me, say, a Holocaust denier, there's no way I'm getting in anybody's office in Congress. So it is just about the worst thing you can be called today. But it really isn't such a bad thing. A Holocaust denier is really just a Holocaust critic, a questioning person who is looking at the facts and seeing that many times they don't particularly add up. That in general is a revisionist historian, no matter what the topic you're talking about. If you believe what Harry Elmer Barnes said, which is victors write the histories, and the first casualty of war is the truth, then you know that books written after the heat of battle, in which the victors are writing these books, are probably designed to make the defeated look as horrible and anti-human or a-human as possible, so that your war was a just war. That being said, at the Barnes Review, We've looked at many aspects of the Holocaust with scholars like Carlo Montagna, Germar Rudolph, Jürgen Graf, Frederick Tobin, Odo Valendi, guys that were very well trained in either history, chemistry, science, or PhDs, so research. And they have written books on all kinds of aspects of the Holocaust. From our point of view, then, we would say that we are Holocaust deniers because, A, we don't believe the 6 million Jews were killed in homicidal gas chambers. Number two, we don't believe that the Wannsee Conference, that the final solution, was an extermination solution to wipe the Jews off the face of the map. As a matter of fact, at the Wannsee Conference, the final solution that they actually discussed was a relocation plan, and one of the places they had in mind was Madagascar. So that being said, yes, if you question just about anything about the Holocaust, you're a Holocaust denier. But like I say, don't feel bad. It's okay. You have some very good company around. You know, the concentration camp system in general was a work camp system. These camps, in our opinion, from the evidence we have, and again, I've sold 25 books at BarnesReview.com on the subject, they were not for extermination. And if you look at the accommodations that were given the prisoners, and by the way, I don't know exactly what percentage of the total prison population of the work camps during World War II under the Third Reich were Jews. I can tell you this, there was lots of Poles, there was priests, there was political dissidents, there was homosexuals, and they were in different camps, but for the most part, these camps were work camps. Take the most famous camp there is, the Auschwitz camp. The Auschwitz camp, we are told, was strictly for the extermination of Jews. They came in, as they come off the train, they were told to be killed immediately, or they were going to be worked to death. Maybe they were going to have medical experiments on them. Of course, this is not true if you know much about the Auschwitz camp in general. They were doing some very sophisticated work in Auschwitz. It was a massive open-air facility. There was multiple Auschwitz work camps, and one of them was in synthetic rubber plant. Yes, I think it was the Buna rubber plant, and they were making synthetic rubber. Now, this is sophisticated work, and so where you might imagine these Jewish prisoners were beaten on their way to the factory or whatever, actually, in reality, they would get up in the morning, come out of their barracks, they would be taken and marched through the open-air facility by their capo, who would have been a Jewish prisoner who was put in charge of them, and they would complete their work in the factory for the day and be marched back to the barracks. Now, in the early days of the war, it was easy to feed them. The railways and the rail lines and public transportation, military transportation lines were all open, so there was no problem in getting the prisoners their food and medical treatment. Of course, one of the things, there are multiple things at Auschwitz which people can hardly believe, is that the prisoners had soccer fields, which they used, a swimming pool. They had multiple camp orchestras, so they were allowed to, the more talented, musically talented prisoners had enough to have, I think, 4 symphonies. They had a playhouse, which they put on their own plays. They had a camp canteen where they could purchase goods, snacks, and whatever else, maybe some other small goods. And, of course, they paid for this because another thing that many people do not know is the prisoners, for the most part, were paid for their work. We know this, too. One of the great resources on the Holocaust that the Barnes Review has put together, which is kind of an all-encompassing thing, was an issue we did way back in 2001, which we've updated multiple times, and I just updated it recently, called the All-Holocaust Issue. In there, you'll see camp money from Theresienstadt, Auschwitz, Buchenwald, Dachau, all the famous camps in which the prisoners were paid and they could use their money in the camp canteen. They could also use their money at the brothel, the camp brothel, and the camp library. So, and there were, I think they said something like 50,000 volumes in the camp library. They also had art studios for the more talented artistic prisoners to do paintings and such. So that was some of the accommodations at Auschwitz and most of these camps. The idea was to keep them alive. They really did want their labor. It was extremely important to have laborers to work in the factories. For instance, just as an aside, after the Battle of France, I think, the Germans, after they quickly defeated the French, took over almost a million and a half prisoners. It was something like one out of every seven Frenchmen at the time, or able-bodied Frenchmen that could fight, and they took them back to work. And you don't hear, of course, of them being gassed in chambers, et cetera, et cetera. But anyway, that's what the camps were truly for. They were, I guess the worst you could say would be slave labor camps, but quite nice, too. Families could stay together. There were Czechoslovakian prisoners later in the war were kind of done as a test case in which they were allowed to never have to don a prison uniform. They could live within their family groups. And had they had a post office at Auschwitz, too, I'm sure the postcards might have been censored if anybody complained too much. But they were able to send letters and other things home. And you can't tell me this is how you would run a death camp if you ever so decided you wanted to do that. But that being said, completely different than what we've been told about that. What we do know is that these camps didn't become the places they were earlier in the war. Once the war started going against Germany, the rail lines were destroyed. They could barely feed their own people, but most importantly, they were unable to give the proper health care to the prisoners. So what was the most dangerous thing to a prisoner? Was it a homicidal gas chamber? And we'll touch on the factuality of what evidence they have for that later. But you have to ask yourself exactly what was going on there. How did they die? And so we do know that typhus was absolutely one of the biggest concerns of the Reich in running their camps. Everybody knows that typhus is carried by lice, right? And so you had to be sure that you could delouse them. And so let's talk about what might happen to a prisoner when he came into a camp. So here we are. We're coming into this extermination camp. We would think the first thing you do would be taken off and killed and shot, if that was the purpose of the camps. But, of course, the first thing they did was shave them, right, to get the lice, make sure there's no lice in their hair, and they would be tattooed with an identification number. Now, I ask you, why go to that trouble if you're just going to go shoot them or hang them or gas them? At any rate, in the early days of the war in Auschwitz, for instance, there was a typhus epidemic. Typhus was spread quickly. Typhus could even be spread by wind. So when there was typhus epidemics, you would see large signs outside the camps, you know, stay clear, typhus can be spread, et cetera, et cetera. So what did they do? The other thing besides shaving them and tattooing them, they would be deloused, and that's where the myth of the chambers comes in. There were gas chambers in the work camps that the Germans had, but they put out Zyklon B. Zyklon B is an insecticide used at the time, I guess, kind of like we used DDT, or was that defoliant? Excuse me, that wasn't an insect killer. But Zyklon B was very effective against lice. And so, sure, they had some chambers for such. Almost every camp is going to have that. Because if a typhus outbreak occurred, it was very difficult to get under control. As a matter of fact, in the early days of Auschwitz, I was going to say, I think a wife and an officer, a German officer, caught typhus and died. So there really weren't any of the gas chambers, the Zyklon B chambers, the delousing chambers, until they started realizing what a problem that lice were going to cause. So people say to me, and I'm going to skip all around here because it's going to go finish off with one thought and then go back chronologically. But towards the end of the war, what do we see? We see, how can you say that there wasn't an extermination when you see these massive numbers of bodies, right, piled up in the camps, being bulldozed, right? And, of course, I always say to people that almost proves that there wasn't a gassing program going on. How do I mean? Well, if those bodies aren't falling apart, and I hate to be kind of yucky, but if they aren't falling apart and rotting, then they've died very recently to be able to hold together and pull them. You know, they take the pictures of them grabbing the German civilians are forced to take the bodies and put them in mass graves. So if you think that those people piled up in the yard there were killed by homicidal gas, you got to be kidding me. First of all, you wouldn't leave that many bodies laying around. They'd have been exposed to extremely deadly gas. You would have had to have men. First of all, you'd have to have functioning gas chambers for the right types of doors, and I'll get to that in a moment. But you'd also have to have special hazmat materials and everything else. So when you look at, and someone should take the time, readers should take the time to look about what time it takes to actually gas a human and what we do. The temperature of the room, of the gas chamber has to be just right. You have to introduce another type of gas to deactivate the poisonous one that's in there. And so if, in fact, and we know that when they liberated, we'll say, these camps, it was very late in the war, and what you're telling me is that the Nazis stuck around, knowing that the Russians were coming in huge numbers and what they were doing, that you were going to stick around until the very last second and kill every single Jew you possibly could, and then just skedaddle and get out of there before the Russians came. Well, that's ridiculous. They did leave the camps, and many Jews decided to go with them. So that kind of tells you what they thought about the difference between being left to the Russians and going with the Germans. So that being said, the big piles of bodies were almost all victims of typhus. We know this, too, because this was all documented by doctors and allied propagandists as well. Let's take one example. Let's take the example of Dachau. Dachau was a camp that everybody's heard of, but it was for political prisoners for the most part. There was five or six types of patches. Everybody's familiar with the big yellow patch with the six-pointed star. But you had political prisoners in there. You had the priests in there. You had homosexuals in there. You had Russians and Poles in there. But anyway, at the end of the war, the typhus epidemic had gotten so bad that when the Americans came, they tried to get doctors to go in there. And they refused to go in, a lot of them. And so the joke about Dachau was that you had more American photographers taking photographs of these piles of dead bodies than you had doctors or staff trying to save the remaining people who had been affected. As a matter of fact, they wouldn't let the prisoners out of Dachau for months and months after the war was over because they couldn't get the typhus epidemic under control. So that was the major killer of that, and that's what we know about Dachau, is that they were more interested in a lot of this stuff as propaganda. And then we have to look at the gas chambers. Now, I can't tell you, like, every single detail about every single camp and every chamber. All I can talk about is generalities, and the books we have at the Barnes Review go into each particular camp. But several things just stick out about the gas chambers. Some of them had locks on the inside. Some of them had cracks in the doors. Some of them didn't have an airtight seal. If anybody has ever seen a real gas chamber, it closes up like a submarine door, right, with the big handles that you turn, right, that lock it in tight. It's got extra insulation around it, so none of this poison gas could get out, not in a submarine, but, you know, water can't get in. But if you look at some of the camp, what they say were gas chambers, they couldn't have possibly functioned as homicidal gas chambers. And it would have been ridiculous, just the logistics of it, the creation of it. The Nazis were really so efficient at everything. Certainly they could have come up with a better way to kill prisoners, which, by the way, they were ready to admit that the Germans kept very good records. And they have, like at Auschwitz, I think it was alleged at one point in time that 4 million people were gassed to death there. But they had very good records. 4,000 or 5,000 were hung, and 4,000 or 5,000 were shot for one reason or another. As a matter of fact, to belie the point that these the mistreatment was accepted, multiple, probably not more than three or four, German officers were either punished. One, I think, was actually shot for abusing prisoners. So certainly not the kind of concern you'd show for someone that you're just going to bring in and slaughter. So the gas chambers themselves are questionable, but then you have very good evidence put up by a guy named John Ball. He was a captain, and he wrote the book Air Photo Evidence. And his book was suppressed because he was an aerial reconnaissance man in World War II, and so he was in charge of photographing large swaths of the Reich for reconnaissance purposes. And, of course, amongst all this, he had great photographs of the camps in action. And his contention that you could see construction being done on the camps, especially by the ones that had been taken over by the Soviets after the war, to actually fake some of these homicidal gas chambers. Any questions there, you got to get air photo evidence, is the book. And so he might see in what's allegedly today a gas chamber, he might see that there was no hole in the roof, because you have to introduce the gas pellets in some way through the roof, I suppose. But you also have to have other things for a gas chamber to work. But anyway, after the war, these were made. There's even, in when you go on a tour of Auschwitz, according to people that go there, they're even showing you something that they admit was that they've kind of doctored up as a gas chamber. But there were also allegations, of course, that the Germans were using gas vans and portable gas vans. And this has all been debunked. Again, another book I have called The Gas Vans, in which these claims are wildly ridiculous. So what evidence do they have? If this is the crime of the last century, and right now it's probably the crime of the 21st century too, historically, at least that's what Holocaust propagandists like to say, then what evidence do they have that they were gassed? Well, they don't have a lot. What they have is eyewitness testimony. By the way, at the end of the war, I think it was in Dachau, we had an American doctor who did hundreds of autopsies. He may have gone from camp to camp, and I'm talking hundreds of cadavers he worked on, and he found not a single evidence, any evidence whatsoever that the prisoners had been gassed to death. It wasn't in their blood. They didn't have the symptoms of it. But let's go back to the eyewitness testimony. I have a book that we call, I think it was the first gassing, and it's a book about Auschwitz, and I hate to say it because it's such a contentious subject, but it's almost laughable in listening to the eyewitnesses. And so the first gassing at Auschwitz, 10 eyewitnesses might say it happened at 8 a.m., 10 a.m., 12 a.m., 1 p.m., 4 p.m., it was night. The next one will say the victims turned blue, they turned green, they turned orange, they turned pink. And they're all so completely different. Oh, the first time that they were gassed, the eyewitnesses said it was 10, it was 20, it was 30, it was 40. So you have absolutely no consistency. When you talk to or listen to survivors, they very rarely have ever said that they saw someone who was killed. Matter of fact, in his example, was one of the best witnesses for the Holocaust, allegedly with a barber from Sobibor. Sobibor was a transit camp. They tried to say that it was extermination camp. I don't know what they're saying now, but they've done multiple forensic studies there, and they haven't been able to find much. They found a graveyard outside, but it turned out to be a pet cemetery, and I think they also found one that was old, an old Jewish cemetery, but certainly not from the time of Sobibor. At any rate, this barber testified that it was just horrible. What he saw was absolutely horrendous. He knew that they were killing people in mass numbers, and they were gassing to death. So what did you actually see, they said, or what did you do? Well, when they came in, I would cut their hair, and then they would remove their belongings. And I think the belongings were taken and usually archived and kept in a central location in the camp. And then they would be stripped for going to the showers, the real showers, the Zyklon B showers, not the homicidal gas chamber alleged showers. So he says, well, what did you hear? And he says, well, they lined up here, and then I heard in the back buzzing. A buzzing. I know it was something to do with the gas chambers, and it was, and then I never saw them again. Of course, he didn't see them again because one of the reasons you had transit camps, separating kind of Soviet, territory from Allied territory was the difference in the rail line gauges. So generally you'd have transit camps for being transferred out of Germany or wherever they've been captured to the Soviet Union. You'd have to stop at a spot to get a railway train that would match the gauge there. At any rate, at the end of the thing, they said, so what is the worst, what was the worst thing you saw? Well, he said, well, I had to cut their hair. And he almost had to laugh that was the worst thing he could possibly remember of his time in Sobibor. He never really saw anything. He never really heard anything. Of course, he didn't see the people. They were showered. They were tattooed. They were dressed in prison garb and shipped off to another work camp in the area. So, the eyewitness testimony is about all they have. And if this was a crime that they were trying to prove in a court of law today, I think they'd be hard pressed to do so. So there's other aspects of the entire thing, very detailed research has gone into from our point of view. And, of course, as we say, if you're going to be a Holocaust denier, all you have to do is deny that less than 6 million were killed. Well, it's funny. It's okay for them to deny aspects of the Holocaust and just be researchers, but when we do it, we're immediately anti-Semitic. Case in point, the change in the number of people who were killed in Auschwitz, right? The famous plaque at Auschwitz said, I'm paraphrasing, but it's pretty close, this is the site where 4 million Jews were killed by Nazi killers, right? And then suddenly, out of the blue, a few years back, that plaque was changed. 1.2 million were killed here, or died here, excuse me, of all causes and all nationalities. So what does that mean? Well, if Auschwitz was responsible for 4 million of the 6 million, and you just lowered that number from 4 million at Auschwitz to 1.2, well, then shouldn't everybody be denying the 6 million figure?
There were less than 8 million Jews in all of Europe, including lands that the Germans never occupied. How do they justify the 6 million figure at all?
That's a very good point, and we have a book on that, too, and it was about Jewish emigration and the Reich. Listen, lots of them moved out when anti-Semitism started getting worse. You know, you people always say, well, why did they lock them up? Well, everybody has the fast answer that Judea declared war on Christianity. That was when world Jewry got together and decided they were going to super punish Nazi Germany by urging an economic boycott all over the world. Okay, fine, that's true. But what people don't know is Germany was winning World War One. World War One, they never lost a battle, from what I understand. They were their trenches were in French territory. They were in pretty decent shape, from what I understand. And then somebody got the United States involved, and the United States tipped the balance against Germany, and that was Woodrow Wilson. And part of that was some machinations behind the scenes with Wilson's own sexual foibles, and that he was having an affair with a woman named Peck, right? And evidently, I believe it was Brandeis, and of course, don't forget Louis Brandeis, but don't forget his own advisor was Mandel House. Anyway, both Jewish guys. And they put pressure on the president to recognize a homeland for the Jews, the part of the Balfour Declaration. And in return for that, in return for recognizing the Balfour Declaration and a Jewish claim on the Holy Land, then they said they talked the president into sending American troops overseas. Well, you know, the Germans didn't really know about it. They just knew that the Americans got involved, and they knew that, honestly, they hadn't been very neutral anyway, as we well know, along the way, helping the Allies, as they did in the early days before we got into World War II. So when the German people found out after the war, of course, as everybody knows, this is such an encompassing subject, but as everybody knows, the Germans were in bad shape in the days after the Versailles Treaty, and what was going on with mass starvation. Remember the stories that it was cheaper for you to burn money than it was for you to make money, because the money was being devalued so quickly. It was like, I forget, $1 million for a cabbage or Reich marks, whatever it was. It was terrible. And once the German people found out that much of the suffering they had and their loss in World War One could have been tied to Jewish political machination in the United States and England, it really did fuel the anti-Semitism. Adolf Hitler came along at a perfect time for him, speaking a nationalist message. His country was a mess. He felt that Jewish interests were manipulating the banking industry, of course, and pornography, and the film, anti-Christian film, anti-German films, the publishing, and it's the same story that could be accused of today if we look at Hollywood and we look at the what passes for entertainment on television and literature and art as well has been debased. But anyway, that being said, he came around at the right time, was able to rally his people by playing on their sentiment, their anti-Jewish sentiments at the time. And it was a unifying thing, and he turned the country around. You can't deny that he turned the country around in a few short years from absolute destitution to near world dominance. Of course, they did it again after World War II. So I guess the Germans are just really industrious. But that being said, that's what kind of got everybody thinking about it. And, of course, there were certain countries that were happy to participate in the relocation of Jews, and this was what this was. Inevitably, Hitler just wanted them out of Germany. He sent many of them to the east, and inevitably, one of his plans was the Madagascar plan. That was his final solution. Of course, the French and the German, the French under Pétain, right, and the Vichy government, we're going to jointly administer the island of Madagascar. Madagascar was a paradise, okay? Very few people were there. There were no Africans there, just the Malaysians still. And it would have been a wonderful place, nice big island, natural resources, and removed. But they rejected that plan. Jews didn't really want to go there. They wanted the Holy Land. And so part of what you said about your population numbers is many Jews did emigrate out of Nazi Germany and go to Palestine. We also know that, and we've written about this in the Barnes Review, that there was kind of the Havara Agreement, the agreement between Zionists and Germany that they would help them leave the country. As a matter of fact, I think they could go with some money, possibly belongings, if they just agreed to leave. So inevitably, that was Hitler's final solution, was to get the Jews to move out, and many of them did. A lot of them didn't really want to go. And by the way, there were also patriotic Jews who fought in the army. There's a book we sold by Brian Rigg called Hitler's Jewish Soldiers. There were thousands of them. And Hitler didn't pick them out and have them assassinated or gassed or anything else. So there's so many things that'll make you a Holocaust denier that you have to be careful. Because if you question any one of all these dogma, and it really is a religion, and you know that, right? I mean, Holocaustianity, I mean, we can sit here and deny that Moses parted the Red Sea or Jesus Christ rose or didn't rise from the dead. You could say that, but you can't say that the Holocaust didn't happen, or you're going to be monetarily or financially punished, you know, or professionally punished, which we have seen here at the Barnes Review. It's the thing that gets us in trouble, although I imagine they're hot on, as you know, white supremacism now, and this is the big problem. The white people are the worst thing that's ever come around. We got to pull the statues down and all this other stuff. So you can't even say anything positive about white culture anymore. But that being said, the Barnes Review is a white-centric publication, historical publication, and we've always thought that one of the reasons they canceled our PayPal and Amazon book account and our Amazon Kindle account and our credit card charging and give us strikes all the time on YouTube is because of the Holocaust. I mean, that's the real one. But let's face it, it's changed in the past few years, and that is you can't say anything positive about white people, white history, white culture, white heroes without being a white supremacist. So
it actually shows the amount of power that they have. In the late 30s and early 40s, Charles Lindbergh warned about Jewish influence getting us into a European war. How do you account for this nation and Europe getting into World War II? What took place, their influence at that time?
Well, and you know, I'm not an expert on everything, and so I can't speak authoritatively on that. However, once again, I have a scholar, Dr. Thomas Dalton, who's just come up with a book called The Jewish Hand in the World Wars, in which he goes over this very subject very carefully. Of course, he'll be branded an anti-Semite for writing it, and we'll be branded anti-Semites for selling it. But the fact of the matter is, it's quote after quote after quote, and it proves your point perfectly. I recommend that book very highly. The number of advisors around Woodrow Wilson and Franklin Roosevelt that were Jewish, who had the interests of the Holy Land, Israel, Palestine, at the forefront of what they were trying to do, and also the vindictiveness which they showed the Germans after the war. By the way, that should be a part of our conversation. It's not only the allegations of the Holocaust, Jewish Holocaust, but I guess most of your readers or listeners know this, but of course what we did to the Germans afterwards was probably unprecedented in world history. In two regards. One was how we treated the POWs, the German POWs, and number two was what happened to the German civilians, ethnic Germans, in lands that were lost by the Germans in the Poland, in Czechoslovakia, in East Prussia, things that became Soviet. I mean, well, James Bach, by the way, is a perfect guy to mention now because he wrote the two seminal books on that, one being Other Losses, which was an examination of the treatment of German POWs in French and American hands after World War II. And I do want to come back to that. And the other one is, that was Other Losses, and he had Crimes and Mercies. And that was about the expulsion of the German civilians from these areas in the tens of millions, in which they estimate that as many as 3 to 4 million German civilians, young children, women, most of the menfolk were done or fighting somewhere, old people trying to make their way in front of the Soviet army out of formerly German lands back to Germany. Millions died. Largest transfer of population possibly in world history. Now, the other side of it is Eisenhower and his death camps. You talk about how you might want to kill people if you really had a bone to doing it and you really wanted to genocide people. You probably wouldn't go to all the trouble in the midst of a war to create a fancy gas chamber, which, as I've mentioned earlier, takes a lot of time to do. Can't get that many. Have to introduce gases to deactivate the L1. Got to have airtight shelters. Got to have hazmat gear. All this stuff. And you're losing the war. Well, why don't you just do what Eisenhower did? At the end of the war, he kind of reclassified these soldiers as, disarmed enemy combatants, I think it was. And he had in his care millions of German prisoners. So what did he do? Did he set up fancy hotels for them like Auschwitz in retrospect, right? With a sauna, and there was a sauna, by the way, there. A sauna and a pool and soccer fields and workers. No, he locked them in outdoor pens in freezing cold and boiling hot weather, depending on where they were, with no sanitation and rations that were less than or slightly more than what a concentration camp prisoner under the Nazis had in the waning days of the war when they simply could no longer feed them. Millions, I think over a million, I better not say millions because I'm not 100% sure, but something like 1.2 million or more. And if I'm wrong and somebody knows, correct me, died under French and American care in possibly a genocide that might have matched what actually did happen in the Holocaust. Let's talk about some of the truths of the Holocaust. Some of the truths are large numbers of Jews died in camps, generally from typhus, nowhere near the numbers they say. The estimates for Auschwitz are not 1.25 million or any of this. Vivian Byrd, in his book, Auschwitz, The Final Count, estimated that 60,000. Now, by the way, this matches Red Cross estimates for what they thought, the number of people that were in the camps, the number of people that were dying, what they saw. Now, does any side try to maybe hide something? Yes, but you can't hide the magnitude of a genocide from the Red Cross, which was allowed access to most of these camps, as far as I know, and took very good records. So how they came up with the 6 million number is kind of a cosmological thing, too. I mean, let's not forget, we could go on for a 10-hour program. But in the Talmud, it is alleged that the Romans killed a billion Jews. Okay, well, that's almost impossible. But we do know that the 6 million number was being bandied about well before World War II. It was being bandied about in World War I. And if you look at the headlines from Eastern Europe, I think under maybe the areas under Bolshevik control, they will say, your help urgently needed. It's always a fundraising thing. Let's not forget the Holocaust is a big fundraising thing. Your help urgently needed. 6 million Jews under threat of starvation, death, whatever. And I don't know if this was like deflection or what. Because we know in 1920s that the Ukrainian famine was going on. This is when Stalin took all the food from the farmers, right, during the collectivization process, and they really did die by the million. But this 6 million number is very important. I believe that it has, and you might know this, Mike, that it's tied in with their predictions of the end times, and that 6 million had to die at the hands of the greatest killer of all time or something like this, because, again, another book we had, we sold for a while, the Holocaust Dogma of Judaism. Very fascinating thing that 6 million number comes up, and it has to be 6 million. It wouldn't pick that out of a hat. this has something to do with the Jewish religion and the Talmud. And so, you know, you always wonder.
Yeah, the number 666 is prominent among those people. They like the number six.
Right. Well, there you go. And so, but now how could you possibly, and we have just touched on the edge of the surface of the Holocaust. How could it possibly be this big a lie? People say to me, you're crazy. How can you deny the Holocaust? First of all, I don't say it. I want to say it back to real quickly. Yes, large numbers of Jews died under German care, especially at the end of the war. Yes, large numbers of Jews were picked up from their homes and placed in slave labor camps, and many were worked to death towards the end of the war when they couldn't get their nutrition. You'd be surprised on the records, again, once again, the Nazis kept great records, how many 35-year-old men were dying of heart attacks. Well, that's a malnutrition thing, and you're still working. And I'm trying to think if there was really anything else. There was existing anti-Semitism, but as far as, like, the beatings and the tortures and all this stuff, and again, camp by camp, I won't even talk about the medical experiments, because they did do medical experiments on Jews, and they made great strides in medicine, but probably would be considered a war crime. At any rate, so when we talk about what we deny and what we don't deny, there's what we don't deny. Jews suffered in World War II. Jews were rounded up. Jews were put in camps. What we do deny is that they were killed by homicidal gas chambers. Now, if in fact that we have done our job, and we have shot this number down from, we'll say, 6 million to, oh, maybe it was 150,000, 100,000, I'm not sure, then all of a sudden you say, well, what was the big deal about this Holocaust? Well, I just said 60 million died in Russia and 60 million in China or more, and blah, blah, blah. We talked about that. So but it has to be the worst. So every time we shoot a camp down, they come up with something else. Like, you know, now the big question that even some revisionists are divided on is how many were killed by German forces and their allies, because many of the areas that the Germans went, which had been formerly ruled by the Bolsheviks, they had lots of recruits that wanted to join Waffen-SS units. These were the Einsatzgruppen we're talking about. So the question is, how many Jews were killed on the Eastern Front? And David Irving, for instance, says it was millions. Other people are saying it's millions. I'm not 100% sure. We do sell a very good two-volume set on Action Reinhardt if you really want to get into the nitty-gritty of it. But the situation was a little bit different. When they came across these victims or enemy there, really, because what they were fighting there were mostly Soviet partisans that just happened to be Jews, they were not dressed in uniforms. And thus the rules of war, and we must have rules of war, otherwise we devolve even worse barbarism than we are in general. Then one of the things you don't do is you don't kill uniformed enemy soldiers and then hide amongst the civilian population. And one of those things is, one of those rules of war is, when you do that, I think you kill X number to one. Could be 3-1, 4-1, 5-1. So I think we would admit that on the Eastern Front, a lot of people got killed. That may not be, you might not be able to exactly follow 100% the total number. That being said, it certainly wasn't a purposeful extermination plan. It was more or less a war zone. And so we have some debate on that, and we'll be looking into those subjects in years to come, because there is more to be done on the subject, because the subject is so important. And the reason it's so important today is because, as I said, this Holocaust comes up all the time. It comes up to punish groups like ours or others who might be anti-Semitic. Why would you be anti-Semitic? What's it got to do with the Holocaust? Well, because you wouldn't talk about the Holocaust, they say, unless what you're trying to do is create animosity against Jews. And that's the last thing we're trying to do. And that's what they don't understand. Here or there, they do understand it, and they just want us to shut up.
Well, the students in the public schools all know the 6 million Jews figure, but they don't know how many Americans or how many British or how many Germans or how many Russians were killed. The only thing that's pumped in their head is there were 6 million Jews killed.
Well, and that is part of this brainwashing. Why is it so important for them? Because it does give us the guilt. It does give them the weapon to hit us with. It does make them the continued victims. And believe me, they've portrayed themselves as victims for a long time, yet I have yet to come across a Jew and I've known many, and many of them are good people, who ever said to me, man, have I been a victim of anti-Semitism today. You know, so usually no, they're usually accepted in society and not that anti-Semitism might be actually a thing of the past. They won't let it die. It's kind of like this white supremacist thing. The fake realities are extremely important. Right now it's us. So white supremacists, anybody talks nice about whites, and has to be, remember, the minute they hear it, they have to be an anti-Semite. And, of course, maybe they're, these days, they're against sex change operations and abortion, we'll say, right? And that makes us evil, too. And so it's a funny, fake reality, but it's deadly serious because of the amount of money that's raised off this. I mean, even Jewish scholars, excuse me, who have come out, look, I'm thinking about Norman Finkelstein, for instance. Norman Finkelstein wrote the book, The Holocaust Industry, and all he had parents that were in the Holocaust, and he said that they, you know, died in the camps. And they may very well have, I just can tell you that they weren't gassed. But he wrote a book just basically discussing how much money was made off this and how they were using the Holocaust for profit. And here's a Jewish guy who, a full believer in the Holocaust, and he lost his tenure, and he got into big trouble, I forget whatever, he's been blackballed. And so even Jews who are willing, his funny thing is, Finkelstein's a Jew, but he's an anti-Semite. So go figure on that one. But yeah, so it's a dangerous topic for anybody to talk about. And the thing is, you talk about those poor kids in school. Well, you know, I can't blame them. They're sometimes they're only like 6 or 7 years old and they're seeing these horrific images and it sticks with them and they believe their teachers and the teachers, if they know better, are probably too scared to say what they really think about it. Because they'll get themselves fired. I mean, we see this all the time. I've had employees, I also work, as you mentioned, for American Free Press, and one of our writers has his own views on the Holocaust, and he got a job with the state government, I think, of California, and somebody looked up his name and said that he had posted stuff that wasn't right on the mainstream line, and they fired the guy. I mean, the lengths they'll go to shut you up must mean we're on to something here. And I don't know what happens when we finally, I mean, will it ever come up like it's a groundswell? You know, a lot of people, like today, you know this, when you talk to people, they're scared to say what's on their mind. And the only place they feel comfortable is in a voting booth because it's the last place we have that's allegedly, right, a secret vote. And a lot of people were talking about President Trump. They might go vote for Trump, but they don't go out telling everybody they're going to vote for Trump because it might cost them their job. So, you know, it's funny, I wish we had a time for another discussion one time about Bolshevism and Judaism and the
proponents. Well, we'll have to have you back on another broadcast.
Very good. I've got some other experts, too. But just what's going on today on the streets is very much a brainwashing program brought out of the re-education camps of Soviet Russia. What they're doing, what they're making people do. The shame, the guilt, the focusing on mass murders, the focusing on school shootings, the focusing on, say, priestly abuse, when we know abuses of some other religions are much worse than our own could ever be. I almost feel like today the news media's purpose is to give us post-traumatic stress syndrome. Just what
and
they
of course, the Jews do own all the public media, the large media, and they
correct.
Their agenda pushes homosexuality and race mixing and things that weren't even thought of when I was a kid.
Well, I know, and I've always used to say, Mom, I'm never going to the grocery store with you again, because she'd say, I remember when a ground beef was 39 cents a pound. I remember when gas was a nickel. Now I'm hitting 60 years old and looking back, and I'm saying, man, things have changed, but they've changed a lot since the Barack Obama presidency as far as what's gone, the social agenda in this country. But I do recommend people take a look at the Barnes Review. I think it's worth a read. We do have some good
stuff. Well,
why don't
you give some information how people can contact you on that?
Sure, absolutely. Go to www.barnesreview.com. We're having a little trouble with our website today because we'll come under attack now and again. You can call us up at 1-877-773-9077. That's 877-773-9077. Tell them that you were on Mike's. You heard this on Mike's radio program, and I'll have him send you a free sample copy of the Barnes Review for the next 30 days, right? So you can check it out. Again, we cover history in a much broader fashion, all the way from Cro-Magnon Man and Neanderthal Man and all the new discoveries they've made about them, to Göbekli Tepe, all the way up through the Cold War in the modern era, election thievery, white accomplishment, ancient history, a lot of World War II, World War I. Of course, we just finished up the past several years as a retrospective, so I've got several theme issues that are very interesting for people, but give us a call there and or check out BarnesReview.com and poke around there. But mostly I would suggest people go ahead and give us a call at that toll-free number and ask for a free copy of the Barnes Review, and we'd be happy to send one out to you.
Well, we've got about a little over a minute, minute and a half left. Would you like to kind of summarize or bring up any other points?
You know, it's I always like to hear what people have to say, because I do resist calling it the whole hoax. I know you like to call it that, but so many people either know or they don't know. But there's a lot of people on the fence, and I always feel like, and I'd like to hear from people, what's the best way to talk to people about this particular subject? Because of all subjects, this is the one that people have been the most brainwashed about. And if they've had any luck proselytizing or discussing with people this issue, I'd love to hear from them. You can email me at paul@barnesreview.org, paul@barnesreview.org. Or you can ask me any question you want to ask me. I'll do my best to answer it. It's an important subject, much more worthy. And by the way, I've got guys that would, if they're willing to get on a radio program, a lot of them are scared for their futures. But I've got some real experts to talk about individual camps and individual killing devices and statistics, population statistics, eyewitness accounts. I mean, this has just been such a cursory thing for me, and it's not my area of expertise either. But I must say, I probably know more than about 90% of the people. But the 10% that knows more than me knows a lot more about it, and they're real professional. The scholars, like I said, chemists and scientists and the authors and historians, and they are an amazing group of people who have made no money on this topic. So tell me why they're talking about it when all it does is bring them grief. They either get locked up or they run. If I have any time left, I'll just say quickly, one scholar I know, and I won't say his name, was trying to adopt two foster children, and he was a great father, had them for years, and the kids had been from a neglected home, and he provided them stability. Well, when it came time to adopt, the kid's attorney, because you got to get the kid's attorney, said he couldn't possibly adopt these children. He was a Holocaust denier. He must be crazy. So it'll get you deep down.
Well, there's definitely persecution. I've known that over the years. But we're just out of time, and I appreciate you being on tonight, and we just need to put on our closing announcement now. And
very good.
Bid our
my pleasure.
Listeners tonight. Well, thank you again.
We pray that your spiritual ears have received today's message, and that you are fed with strong meat relevant to solving the needs of our nation and Christian civilization everywhere. Herald of Truth is sponsored by Kingdom Identity Ministries through the financial support and prayers of listeners like you who love the truth of God's Word and want to see it broadcast throughout the land to awaken His people. If you would like a
CD
of today's message, tell us the date and station to which you are listening and send a donation to cover our cost plus help with radio time to Kingdom Identity Ministries, Post Office Box 1021, Harrison, Arkansas, 72602. We would appreciate donations made by our international listeners to be in U.S. funds. For a free introductory packet of information, including our doctrinal statement of beliefs, plus lists of books and tapes to aid you in your study of biblical truth, write Kingdom Identity Ministries, Post Office Box 1021, Harrison, Arkansas, 72602, USA. Or request this material by calling 870-741-1119. That's 870-741-1119. Visit our internet website by going to www.kingidentity.com. Type www.kingidentity.com. We invite you to listen regularly to Herald of Truth broadcast for more dynamic messages proclaiming the gospel of the kingdom at this same time and station.